Recovering from the tragedy, Ellie tried to spend some time on Cocoa Beach. She had borrowed an apartment that overlooked the beach and the Atlantic Ocean. She would bring along pieces of bread to throw to the seagulls. There were moments when 20 or 30 seagulls would hover just a meter or two above her head. They grazed past each other in apparent random motion, but the overall effect was a stationary pattern. One day she noticed a small and, in its humble way, a perfect palm frond lying at the edge of the beach. She picked it up, carefully wiped off the sand, and brought it home in her suitcase. After the destruction of the American machine, the World Machine Consortium concluded that it might be years before the American effort was back on track. The Russian machine, which had been having technical difficulties, might take even longer to finish. But they discovered that the component testing facility at Hokkaido, Japan, in addition to testing each component, had been secretly assembling an identical copy of the machine. It was generally agreed that the director of the Hokkaido facility proposed that they finish assembling the machine, and when it was ready, the World Machine Consortium could decide whether they would like to give it a try. The security risk was considered small because it was the machine itself, much more than these five people, that was essential for the success of the project. In a rational world, they would be easy to replace, Ellie thought, although the political impediments in selecting five humans acceptable to all members of the consortium had been considerable. Vega Lunacharsky had been chosen as the Russian crew member to Ellie's delight. Devi Sukhavati, physician, molecular biologist, a woman of great dignity and accomplishment, had become a friend as well as an admired colleague. Shi Chu Mu she knew less well, but she liked everything she knew about him and was fascinated by his archaeological discoveries of 3rd century BC China and of the great emperor Xin, after whom the nation was named. The fifth member of the crew, it had been decided, was Abonema Ada of Nigeria, a Nobel laureate in physics who had developed an elegant theory of superunification. A modest, laconic young man in his 30s, he was a fierce opponent of the Muslim concept of jihad, holy war, and argued instead for the most vigorous free exchange of ideas. He was devoted to improving conditions for young scientists in his country. Every member of the crew was in some sense a rebel. By early July, the machine was once again taking shape. Here in Hokkaido, the dowels had been mounted and the dodecahedron completed, although no public announcement had been made. Japanese commentators talked of Machindo, the way of the machine, the increasingly common perspective of all humans sharing an equal stake in the Earth's future. But if the machine doesn't work and the message goes away, how long, Ellie wondered, would the insight last? Even if we have made some mistake in interpretation or construction, even if we never understand anything more about the Vegans, the message demonstrates beyond a shadow of a doubt that there are other beings in the universe and that they are more advanced than we. That should keep the planet unified for a while. The time of the activation of the machine was kept secret. After a few last-minute delays, it turned out to be the end of the last month of 1900 and anything. The extraterrestrials had specified in painstaking detail the mass of each machine component and the total permissible mass. Very little was left over for equipment of terrestrial design. A variety of miniature cameras, spectrometers, superconducting supercomputers, and microfilm libraries were being urged on the crew. They were taking only a minimum of provisions, some of them stuffed in the pockets of their coveralls. Devi was to carry a rudimentary medical kit. Ellie planned to bring only a toothbrush and a change of underwear. If they can get me to Vega in a chair, she thought, they'll probably be able to provide the amenities as well. If she needed a camera, she told project officials, she'd just ask the Vegans for one. But even a single two-dimensional photograph of an alien machine could be invaluable, the officials said. And imagine a picture of the aliens themselves. Would she please reconsider and bring a camera? Dahir, who was now on Hokkaido with a large American delegation, told her to be serious. The stakes were too high for... But she cut him short with a look so withering that he could not complete the sentence. She knew what he was going to say. For childish behavior. Amazingly, Dahir was acting as if he had been the injured party in their relationship. She described it all to Devi, who was not fully sympathetic. Dahir, she said, was very sweet. Eventually, Ellie agreed to take an ultra-miniaturized video camera. In the manifest that the project required, under personal effects, she listed Frond, palm, 0.811 kilograms. Derheer was sent to reason with her. You know, there's a splendid infrared imaging system you can carry along for 2/3 of a kilogram. Why would you want to take the branch of a tree? A frond. A palm frond. It's all in Ivanhoe. Didn't you read it in high school? At the time of the Crusades, pilgrims who made the long journey to the Holy Land took back a palm frond to show they'd really been there. It's to keep my spirits up. Now, the earth is my holy land. I'll bring a frond to show them where I came from. Derheer only shook his head, but when she described her reasons to Vege, he said, "This I understand very well." The palm frond served another purpose, she realized. She needed something to remind her of Earth. She was afraid she might be tempted not to come back. The day before the machine was to be activated, Ellie received a small package. There was no return address, and inside no note or signature. The package held a gold medallion on a chain. Inscriptions had been engraved on both sides, small but readable. One side read, "Hera, superb queen, with the golden robes, commanded Argus, whose glances bristle out through the world." On the obverse was the response of the defenders of Sparta to the commander of the Roman army. "If you are a god, you will not hurt those who have never injured you. If you are a man, advance, and you will find men equal to yourself, and women." She knew who had sent it. It could have only come from Palmer Joss. On activation day, they took an opinion poll of the senior staff on what would happen. Most thought that the machine would not work. A smaller number believed that the five would somehow find themselves very quickly in the Vega system, relativity to the contrary notwithstanding. Others suggested, variously, that the machine was a vehicle for exploring the solar system, the most expensive practical joke in history, a classroom, a time machine, or a galactic telephone booth. One scientist wrote, "Five very ugly replacements with green scales and sharp teeth will slowly materialize in the chairs." This was the closest to the Trojan horse scenario in any of the responses. Another, but only one, read, "Doomsday machine." There was a ceremony of sorts. Speeches were made, food and drink were served. People hugged one another. Some cried quietly. Only a few were openly skeptical. You could sense that if anything at all happened on activation, the response would be thunderous. There was an intimation of joy in many faces. There had not been much in the way of national briefings. National leaders sent short statements on videotape. President Lasker's was especially fine, Ellie thought. "This is not a briefing and not a farewell. It's just a so long. If you are to be transported to somewhere else, then see for all of us, not just the science, but everything you learn. You represent the entire human species, past, present, and future. Whatever happens, your place in history is secure. You are heroes of our planet. Speak for all of us, be wise, and come back." A few hours later, for the first time, they entered the machine, one by one, through a small airlock. Recessed interior lights came on. Even after the machine had been completed and had passed every prescribed test, project officials were afraid to have the five take their places prematurely. They were afraid that merely sitting down might induce the machine to operate, even if the benzels were stationary. But here they were, and nothing extraordinary was happening so far. Ellie leaned back, a little gingerly to be sure, into the molded and cushioned plastic. Chintz slip covers would have been perfect for these chairs, but plastic had seemed more modern, more scientific, more serious. Knowing of Vege's careless smoking habits, they had decreed that no cigarettes could be carried on board the machine. Lunacharsky had uttered fluent maledictions in 10 languages, and now he entered after the others, having finished his last lucky strike. He wheezed just a little as he sat down beside Ellie. The machine goes somewhere, Ellie thought. It was a means of conveyance, an aperture to elsewhere, or elsewhen. It could carry you out of the stifling provincial towns of your childhood to the great crystal cities. It was discovery and escape and an end to loneliness. It was not glory she was seeking, not mainly, not much, but instead a kind of liberation. Her heart sang in anticipation. She would discover, she was sure, What else is possible? What could be accomplished by other beings, great beings, beings who had, it seemed likely, been voyaging between the stars when the ancestors of humans were still swinging from branch to branch in the dappled sunlight of the forest canopy? Drummond, like many others she had known over the years, had called her an incurable romantic. She found herself wondering again why so many people thought it some embarrassing disability. Her romanticism had been a driving force in her life and a fount of delights. Advocate and practitioner of romance, she was off to see the wizard. A status report came through by radio. There were no apparent malfunctions. Their main wait was for the evacuation of the space between and around the Benzels. A system of extraordinary efficiency was pumping out the air to attain the highest vacuum ever reached on Earth. She double-checked the stowage of her video microcamera system and gave the palm frond a pat. Two of the spherical shells had now spun up to what the message had defined as critical speed. They were already a blur to those watching outside. The third Benzel would be there in a minute. A strong electrical charge was building up. When all three spherical shells with their mutually perpendicular axes were up to speed, the machine would be activated, or so the message had said. Xi's face showed fierce determination, Ellie thought. Lunacharsky's a deliberate calm. Sukhavati's eyes were open wide. She caught Ellie's glance and smiled. Ada revealed only an attitude of quiet attentiveness. Devi caught her glance and smiled. She wished she had had a child. It was her last thought before the walls flickered and became transparent, and it seemed the earth opened up and swallowed her. They were falling. The pentagonal panels of the dodecahedron had become transparent. So had the roof and the floor. Above and below, Ellie could make out the organosilicate structure and the implanted erbium dowels, which seemed to be stirring. All three Benzels had disappeared. The dodecahedron plunged, racing down a long, dark tunnel just broad enough to permit its passage. The acceleration seemed somewhere around 1G. It was hard not to entertain the thought that they had plunged into the mantle of the Earth, bound for its core of molten iron. There was a texture to the tunnel walls from which she could sense their speed. The patterns were irregular, soft-edged mottlings, nothing with a well-defined form. Even a few hundred kilometers beneath the Earth's surface, the rocks would be glowing with red heat. There was no hint of that. Every now and then, a forward vertex of the dodecahedron would brush the wall, and flakes of an unknown material would be scraped off. The dodec itself seemed unaffected. Soon, quite a cloud of fine particles was following them. Every time the dodecahedron touched the wall, she could sense an undulation, as if something soft had retreated to lessen the impact. The faint yellow lighting was diffuse, uniform. Occasionally, the tunnel would swerve gently, and the dodec would obligingly follow the curvature. She could feel a continuous physical anxiety in the pit of her stomach. Black hole, she thought. I'm falling through the event horizon of a black hole toward the dread singularity. Or maybe this isn't a black hole and I'm headed toward a naked singularity. Near a singularity, causality could be violated. Effects could precede causes, time could flow backward, and you were unlikely to survive, much less remember the experience. For a rotating black hole, there was not a point, but a ring singularity, or something still more complex to be avoided. Black holes were nasty. The gravitational tidal forces were so great that you would be stretched into a long, thin thread if you were so careless as to fall in. You would also be crushed laterally. Happily, there was no sign of any of this. Through the gray, transparent surfaces that were now the ceiling and floor, she could see a great flurry of activity. The organosilicate matrix was collapsing on itself in some places and unfolding in others. The embedded erbium dowels were spinning and tumbling. Everything inside the dodec, including Ellie and her companions, looked quite ordinary. Well, maybe a bit excited, but they were not yet long, thin threads. These were idle ruminations, she knew. The physics of black holes was not her field. Anyway, she could not understand how this could have anything to do with black holes, which were either primordial, made during the origin of the universe, or produced in a later epoch by the collapse of a star more massive than the sun. Then, the gravity would be so strong that except for quantum effects, even light could not escape. Hence black. Hence whole. But they hadn't collapsed a star, and she couldn't see any way in which they had captured a primordial black hole. Anyway, no one knew where the nearest primordial black hole might be hiding. They had only built the machine and spun up the benzos. She glanced over to Ada, who was figuring something on a small computer. By bone conduction, she could feel as well as hear a low-pitched roaring, and she raised her voice to be heard. "Do you understand what's going on?"
"Not at all. I can almost prove this can't be happening. Do you know the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates?"
"No, sorry."
"I'll explain it to you later."
She was glad he thought there would be a later. Ellie felt the deceleration before she could see it, as if they had been on the downslope of a roller coaster, had leveled out, and now were slowly climbing. Just before the deceleration, the tunnel had made a complex sequence of bobs and weaves. There was no perceptible change in either the color or the brightness of the surrounding light. She picked up the camera, switched to the long focal-length lens, and looked as far ahead as she could. Magnified, the texture of the wall seemed intricate, irregular, and just for a moment, faintly self-luminous. The dodecahedron had slowed to a comparative crawl. No end to the tunnel was in sight. She wondered if they would make it to wherever they were going. Perhaps the designers had miscalculated. Maybe the machine had been built imperfectly, just a little bit off. Perhaps what had seemed on Hokkaido an acceptable technological imperfection would doom their mission to failure here in wherever this was. Or glancing at the cloud of fine particles following and occasionally overtaking them, she thought maybe they had bumped into the walls one time too often and lost more momentum than had been allowed for in the design. The space between the dodec and the walls seemed very narrow now. Perhaps they would find themselves stuck fast in this never-never land and languish until the oxygen ran out. Could the Vegans have gone to all this trouble and forgotten that we need to breathe? Hadn't they noticed all those shouting Nazis? Vega and Ada were deep in the arcana of gravitational physics. Twisters, renormalization of ghost propagators, time-like killing vectors, non-abelian gauge invariants, geodesic refocusing, 11-dimensional Kaluza-Klein treatments of supergravity, and of course Ada's own and quite different superunification. You could tell at a glance that an explanation was not readily within their grasp. At a shout from Shi, everyone noticed that the walls of the tunnel were undulating, closing in on the dodecahedron, squeezing it forward. A nice rhythm was being established. Every time the dodec would slow almost to a halt, it was given another squeeze. Ellie felt a slight motion sickness. In some places, it was tough going, the walls working hard, waves of contraction and expansion rippling down the tunnel. Elsewhere, especially on the straightaways, they would fairly skip along. A great distance away, Ellie made out a dim point of light growing in intensity. A blue-white radiance began flooding the inside of the dodecahedron, glinting off the black erbium cylinders, now almost stationary. The contrast between the subdued ambient light for most of the trip and the swelling brilliance ahead was striking. They were rushing toward it, shooting up the tunnel and then erupting into what seemed to be ordinary space. Before them was a huge blue-white sun, disconcertingly close. Ellie knew in an instant it was Vega. Ellie placed a piece of white paper in the focal plane of the long lens and projected a bright image of the star. She could see two great sunspot groups and a hint, she thought, a shadow of some of the material in the ring plane. Putting down the camera, she held her hand at arm's length, palm outward, to just cover the disk of Vega, and was rewarded by seeing a brilliant, extended corona around the star. It had been invisible before, washed out in Vega's glare. Palm still outstretched, she examined the ring of debris that surrounded the star. The nature of the Vega system had been the subject of worldwide debate ever since receipt of the prime number message. Acting on behalf of the astronomical community of Earth, she hoped she was not making any serious mistakes. She videotaped at a variety of f-stops and frame speeds. They had emerged almost in the ring plane, in a debris-free circumstellar gap. The ring was extremely thin compared with its vast lateral dimensions. She could make out faint color gradations within the rings, but none of the individual ring particles. Perhaps the Vegan rings were composed entirely of specks of dust, clods of rock, shards of ice. She looked back at where they had emerged and saw a circular blackness, blacker than velvet, blacker than the night sky. As she peered through the lens more closely, she thought she could see faint, erratic flashes of light from its very center. Hawking radiation? No, its wavelength would be much too long. Or light from the planet Earth still rushing down the tube. On the other side of that blackness was Hokkaido. Planets. Where were the planets? She scanned the ring plane with a long lens, searching for embedded planets, or at least for the home of the beings who had broadcast the message. But she could find nothing. She asked, "You can't find any planets?" "Nothing. There's a few big comets in close. I can see the tails, but nothing that looks like a planet. There must be thousands of separate rings. As far as I can tell, they're all made of debris. The black hole seems to have cleared out a big gap in the rings. That's where we are right now, slowly orbiting Vega. The system is very young, only a few hundred million years old, and some astronomers thought it was too soon for there to be planets. But then, where did the transmission come from?" She, whose eyesight was acute, was staring up, through the organosilicate matrix, out the transparent pentagonal panels, into the sky far above the ring plane. He said nothing, and Ellie followed his gaze. There was something there, all right, gleaming in the sunlight and with a perceptible angular size. She looked through the long lens. It was some vast, irregular polyhedron, each of its faces covered with a kind of a circle. Disc? Dish? Bowl? She held out the video camera to Shi.
"Yes, I see. Your counterparts, radio telescopes. Thousands of them, pointing in many directions. It is not a world. It is only a device."
They took turns using the long lens, Ellie concealing her impatience to look again. She understood the advantage of putting the telescopes in polar orbit around the star, safe except for twice each revolution from collisions with ring plane debris. Radio telescopes pointing all over the sky, thousands of them, suggested some comprehensive sky survey, an Argus in earnest. Innumerable candidate worlds were being watched for television transmission, military radar, and perhaps other varieties of early radio transmissions unknown on Earth. Did they find such signals often, she wondered? Or was the Earth their first success in a million years of looking? There was no sign of a welcoming committee. Was a delegation from the provinces so unremarkable that no one had been assigned even to note their arrival? When the lens was returned to her, she took great care with focus, f-stop, and exposure time. She wanted a permanent record to show the National Science Foundation what really serious radio astronomy was like. She wished there was a way to determine the size of the polyhedral world. The telescopes covered it like barnacles on a whale. A radio telescope in zero-G could be essentially any size. After the pictures were developed, she would be able to determine the angular size, maybe a few minutes of arc, but the linear size, the real dimensions, that was impossible to figure out unless you knew how far away the thing was. Nevertheless, she sensed it was vast. She was saying, "If there are no worlds here, then there are no Vegans. No one lives here. Vega is only a guardhouse, a place for the Border Patrol to warm their hands. Those radio telescopes are the watchtowers of the Great Wall. If you are limited by the speed of light, it is difficult to hold a galactic empire together. You order the garrison to put down a rebellion. 10,000 years later, you find out what happened. Too slow. So you give autonomy to the garrison commanders. Then no more empire. But those..." He gestured at the receding blot covering the sky behind them. "Those are the imperial roads. Persia had them, and Rome, and China. Then you are not restricted to the speed of light. With roads, you can hold an empire together." As she took short video pans of the debris ring before her, Ellie wondered whether it would someday form its own planetary system, the particles colliding, sticking, growing ever larger, gravitational condensations taking place, until at last only a few large worlds orbited the star. She attempted a panning shot, beginning inside the dodecahedron, then out to the struts joining the transparent pentagonal panels, and beyond to the gap in the debris rings in which they, along with the black hole, were orbiting. She followed the gap, flanked by two bluish rings, farther and farther. There was something a little odd up ahead, a kind of bowing in the adjacent inner ring. She handed the long lens to Shi. "Look over there. Tell me what you see." After a moment, he found it. She could tell because of his slight but quite unmistakable intake of breath.
Another black hole, much bigger. They were falling again. This time the tunnel was bigger, Ellie said. That's it. They take us to Vega to show off their black holes. They give us a look at their radio telescopes from 1,000 kilometers away. We spend 10 minutes there and they pop us into another black hole and ship us back to Earth. That's why we spent $2 trillion? Vega said. Maybe we're beside the point. Maybe the only real point was to plug themselves into the Earth. Ada was making a calming gesture. Wait and see. This is a different tunnel. Why should you think it goes back to Earth? Vega's not where we're intended to go, Devi asked. The experimental method. Let's see where we pop out next. In this tunnel, there were fewer undulations, but the deceleration stage, the part of the passage that felt uphill, was still disconcerting. This time, the light at the end of the tunnel was orange. They emerged at a considerable speed into the system of a contact binary, two suns touching. The outer layers of a swollen, elderly red giant star were pouring onto the photosphere of a vigorous, middle-aged yellow dwarf, something like the sun. The zone of contact between the two stars was brilliant. Ellie looked for debris rings, or planets, or orbiting radio observatories, but could find none. Because there were no rings, there was less scattered light in this system. With the wide-angle lens, she was able, after a bit of searching, to recognize a constellation that sufficiently resembled the Big Dipper. But she had difficulty recognizing the other constellations. Since the bright stars in the Big Dipper are a few hundred light-years from Earth, she concluded that they had not jumped farther than that. She told this to Ada and asked him what he thought.
What do I think? I think this is an underground, a metro, a subway. There are the stations, the stops. Vega and this system and others. Passengers get on and off at the stops. You can change trains here, but we cannot get off. We are in a closed railway car. We're headed for the terminal, the end of the line.
Of the five, Ellie was the only observational astronomer, even though her specialty was not in the optical spectrum. She tried to accumulate as much data as possible in the systems into which they periodically emerged. The presumptive black hole from which they exited would always be in orbit around some star or multiple star system. The black holes were always in pairs, sharing a similar orbit, one from which they were ejected and another into which they fell. Not two systems were closely similar. None was very like the solar system. All provided instructive astronomical insights. Not one of them exhibited anything like an artifact. This time they emerged near a star visibly changing its brightness. Next was a quintuple system. Then a feebly luminous brown dwarf. Some were in open space, some were embedded in nebulosity, surrounded by glowing molecular clouds. Despite a conscious effort to retain a professional calm, her heart soared at this profusion of suns. But after the fourth jump, she began to worry. Subjectively, and by her wristwatch, it felt something like an hour since they had left Hokkaido. If this took much longer, the absence of amenities would be felt. Probably there were aspects of human physiology that could not be deduced even after attentive television viewing by a very advanced civilization. And if the extraterrestrials were so smart, why were they putting us through so many little jumps? All right, maybe the hop from Earth used rudimentary equipment because only primitives were working one side of the tunnel. But after Vega, why couldn't they jump us directly to wherever the Dodek was going? As they plunged down still another tunnel, this one broader and more tortuous than the others, Vega asked Ada to guess why the subway stops were put in such unpromising star systems.
Why not around a single star, a young star in good health and with no debris?
Because, of course, I'm only guessing because all such systems are inhabited, Sugavati interrupted. And they don't want the tourists scaring the natives, Ada smiled. Or the other way around.
But that's what you mean, isn't it? That there's some sort of ethic of non-interference with primitive planets? They know that every now and then some of the primitives might use the subway.
Ellie continued the thought.
And they're pretty sure of the primitives, but they can't be absolutely sure. After all, primitives are primitive. So you let them ride only on subways, they go to the sticks. The builders must be a very cautious bunch.
But then why did they send us a local train and not an express? She said.
Probably it's too hard to build an express tunnel.
A few of the turns were quite steep now. She thought about her Thunderbird, and then she thought about getting sick. She decided she would fight it as long as she could. The dodecahedron had not been equipped with air sickness bags. Abruptly, they were on a straightaway, and then the sky was full of stars. Everywhere she looked, there were stars, not the paltry scattering of a few thousand still occasionally known to naked-eye observers on Earth, but a vast multitude surrounding them in every direction, many almost touching their nearest neighbors, it seemed. The sky was blazing. She could make out an immense spiraling cloud of dust, an accretion disk apparently flowing into a black hole of staggering proportions, out of which flashes of radiation were coming like heat lightning on a summer's night. If this was the center of the galaxy, as she suspected, it would be bathed in synchrotron radiation. She hoped the extraterrestrials had remembered how frail humans were. And swimming into her field of view as the dodec rotated was a prodigy, a wonder, a miracle. It filled half the sky. On its surface were hundreds, perhaps thousands, of illuminated doorways, each with a different shape. Some had projecting appendages or a sequence of partly overlapping off-center circles. She realized they were docking ports, some perhaps only meters in size, others clearly kilometers across. Every one of them, she decided, was the template of some interstellar machine like this one. Big creatures in serious machines had imposing entry ports. Little creatures, like us, had tiny ports. The diversity of ports implied a breathtaking diversity of beings and cultures. Talk about Grand Central Station. The vision of a populated galaxy, of a universe spilling over with life and intelligence, made her want to cry for joy. They were approaching a yellow-lit port, which Ellie could see was the exact template of the dodecahedron in which they were riding. She watched a nearby docking port where something the size of the dodecahedron and shaped approximately like a starfish was gently insinuating itself onto its template. She glanced left and right, up and down, at the almost imperceptible curvature of this great station, situated at what she guessed was the center of the Milky Way. What a vindication for the human species, invited here at last. There's hope for us, she thought. There's hope. Both the interior and the exterior doors of the airlock opened simultaneously. Apparently, this sector of Grand Central was adequately pressurized and oxygenated. Video camera in hand, Ellie waited to exit, but then decided that the palm frond should be with her when she set foot on this new world. As she went to retrieve it, she heard a whoop of delight from outside, probably from Vega. She rushed into the bright sunlight. It was a beach. Waves were lapping on the sand. The blue sky sported a few lazy cumulus clouds. There was a stand of palm trees a little back from the water's edge. A sun was in the sky. One sun. A yellow one. Just like ours, she thought. The air smelled of cloves, perhaps, and cinnamon. It could have been a beach on Zanzibar. So they had voyaged 30,000 light-years to walk on a beach. The breeze stirred and a little whirlwind of sand rose before her. Was all this just some elaborate simulation? Or had the five of them undertaken this epic voyage only to improve their knowledge of descriptive astronomy and then been unceremoniously dumped into some pleasant corner of the Earth? When she turned, she discovered that the dodecahedron had disappeared. They had left the superconducting supercomputer and its reference library, as well as some of the instruments aboard. It worried them for about a minute, but they were safe, and they had survived the trip. Vega glanced from the frond she'd struggled to bring here to the palm trees along the beach and laughed. "Calls to Newcastle." But her frond was different. Wherever this was, the Indian Ocean or the center of the galaxy, the five of them had done something unparalleled. The itinerary and destinations were entirely out of their hands, it was true, but they had crossed the ocean of interstellar space and begun what surely must be a new age in human history. She was very proud. She removed his boots and rolled up his pant legs to amble through the gentle surf. Devi stepped behind a palm tree and emerged sari-clad, her jumpsuit over her arm. Ada produced the sort of linen hat that was his visual trademark throughout the world. Ellie videotaped them in short, jumpy takes. It would look, when they got home, exactly like a home movie. She joined She and Vega in the surf. It was a pleasant afternoon, and everything considered, a welcome change from the Hokkaido winter they had left little more than an hour before. Vega said,
Everyone has brought something symbolic except me. Sukhavati and Ada bring national costumes, you have your palm frond, and she here has brought a grain of rice. Indeed, she was holding the grain in a plastic bag. But me, I have brought no symbols, no mementos from Earth. I'm the only real materialist in the group, and everything I've brought is in my head. I would kill for a cigarette. The five of them sat together by a little tide pool. The surf made a soft, white noise that reminded her of Argus and her years of listening to cosmic static. The sun was well past the zenith over the ocean. A crab scuttled by, its eyes swiveling on their stalks. With crabs, coconuts, and the limited provisions in their pockets, they could survive comfortably enough for some time. There were no footprints on the beach besides their own. Vegate was explaining his and Ada's thinking on what the five of them had experienced. We think they did almost all the work. All the project did was to make the faintest pucker in space-time, so they would have something to hook their tunnel onto. In all of that multidimensional geometry, it must be very difficult to detect a tiny pucker in space-time, even harder to fit a nozzle onto it. Ellie asked, "What are you saying? They changed the geometry of space?" "Yes. We're saying that space is topologically non-simply connected. It's like... I know Ada doesn't like this analogy. It's like a flat, two-dimensional surface. The smart surface connected by some maze of tubing with some other flat, two-dimensional surface, the dumb surface. The only way you can get from the smart surface to the dumb surface in a reasonable time is through the tubes. Now imagine that the people on the smart surface lower a tube with a nozzle on it. They will make a tunnel between the two surfaces, provided the dumb ones cooperate by making a little pucker on their surface so the nozzle can attach itself." Ellie frowned. "But if they're truly two-dimensional beings, how could they make a pucker on their surface?" Vege said, "By accumulating a great deal of mass in one place." "But that's not what we did." "No, it isn't. Somehow the Benzels did it," Ada explained. "You see, if the tunnels are black holes, there are real contradictions implied. There is an interior tunnel in the exact Kerr solution of the Einstein field equations, but it's unstable. The slightest perturbation would seal it off and convert the tunnel into a physical singularity through which nothing can pass. I have tried to imagine a superior civilization that would control the internal structure of a collapsing star to keep the interior tunnel stable. This is very difficult. The civilization would have to monitor and stabilize the tunnel forever. It would be especially difficult with something as large as the dodecahedron falling through." Vege said, "Even if Abunemo can discover how they keep the tunnel open, there are many other problems, too many. Black holes collect problems faster than they collect matter. There are the tidal forces. We should have been torn apart in the black hole's gravitational field. We should have been stretched like people in the paintings of El Greco or the sculptures of that Italian." He turned to Ellie. "Giacometti, he was Swiss." "Yes, then other problems. As measured from Earth, it takes an infinite amount of time for us to pass through a black hole, and we could never, never return to Earth. Maybe this is what happened. Maybe we will never go home. Then there should be an inferno of radiation near the singularity. This is a quantum mechanical instability." Ada took up the explanation. "And finally, a Kerr-type tunnel can lead to grotesque causality violations. With a modest change of trajectory inside the tunnel, one could emerge from the other end as early in the history of the universe as you might like. A picosecond after the Big Bang, for example. That would be a very disorderly universe." "Look, fellas, I'm no expert in general relativity, but didn't we see black holes? Didn't we fall into them? Didn't we emerge out of them? Isn't a gram of observation worth a ton of theory?" Vege groaned. I know. It has to be something else. Our understanding of physics can't be so far off, can it, Abunemo?" Ada shrugged. "A naturally occurring black hole can't be a tunnel. They have impassable singularities at their centers."